basically what the court said was that those who spill oil and those who pollute the environment from hazardous waste sites have to pay for the full cost of restoring the environment, as well as paying for the lost uses that the public would have put those resources to if there hadn't been the spill. So we think it has very significant ramifications, not just in the case of the Exxon Valdez, where it clearly will affect what happens, but also for the 6,000 to 10,000 oil spills that happen every year and the several thousand Superfund sites across the country.
So far, no word from the Department of Interior on a possible appeal to the Supreme Court. Whether the government appeals or not, it now appears likely that the litigation against Exxon in the wake of the Exxon Valdez will be fought without U.S. government damage assessment guidelines. That's the opinion of Alaska Attorney General Douglas Bailey. Bailey says it will be several months before any new regulations could be put in place, and he doubts they'll cover past events like the Exxon Valdez. That may alter Exxon's calculations if the company had been counting its liabilities according to the old rules, but it won't change the state's plans. Bailey has been aware for some time about the shaky legal condition of these guidelines, and he ordered his attorneys to ignore these regulations while building the state's case. Bailey says he hasn't read this ruling yet, but it'll be interesting to see how Interior goes about rewriting its regulations, whether the bureaucrats will take a fresh look at damage assessment or simply touch up the old regulations to meet the minimum standards of the court order. The Attorney General says if Interior does come out with a new method of calculating oil spill damages, the state will certainly have some comments to make. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Exxon proposes to put one incinerator in Valdez, another in Kukag Bay on the Alaska Peninsula. No location has been specified for the two other incinerators. Chris Benson of the Alaska Center for the Environment says her organization adamantly opposes the use of one of the incinerators. It's called a silo, and it's designed to handle wood waste from pulp mills.
It's absolutely inappropriate for use with these types of wastes. It's primitive. It doesn't have state-of-the-art air pollution controls. The little air pollution control it has, they have a possibility of just bypassing that altogether. And this is a type of burner that was in Washington, and Washington State didn't even want it there for burning wood waste. It's just ridiculous, I think, that Exxon would try and use basically what's cheap and expedient, not what's going to be protective of the environment and the public health.
The other three incinerators are rotary kiln devices. The issue there is not with the incinerators, but with what's going to be burned in the incinerators. It could be oily rocks and gravel, absorbent pads, kelp, or rain gear. Benson says VECO standard issue rain gear has chlorine in it, and if that's burned, the chlorine could combine with hydrocarbons to form toxic dioxins. She says another source of chlorine might be the salt water itself, in which case all the waste could produce dangerous emissions. Benson says DEC should conduct a test burn, which DEC does intend to do.
But what's vital is to look at exactly what are they going to test for. And if all they test for are conventional pollutants like carbon dioxide and nitrous oxides, it's not good enough. They need to test for air toxics. They need to know, is it safe or not? So, yes, we're asking for a test burn, but we want a comprehensive monitoring of that test burn. And the permits, as they're written now, don't require that testing until 2 weeks after they've started. And we think they should be doing it before they ever get the permit, not 2 weeks after they've been running.
Another problem Benson has with the incinerator issue is the lack of information. It's not clear what's going to be burned, how the waste will be managed, or where the other two incinerators are going to be placed. That makes it difficult for the public to analyze the issue. Meanwhile, Benson says the public is completely unaware waste has been shipped up to the North Slope and has been burning up there for weeks.
They've been burning something, I think it's 8 tons a day up on the North Slope. And because that municipal incinerator already has a permit, there was no public process regarding that. Likewise, there's three hospital waste burners in Valdez that started burning in May or June. Again, with no public process whatsoever because DEC allowed Exxon to slip through a loophole in the air regulations. And those burners are going every day, and the only thing DEC says they do is watch to see that the black smoke isn't coming out, and that's the only kind of inspection or monitoring that they've got.
Chris Benson of the Alaska Center for the Environment. By law, air quality permits do not require public hearings. DEC scheduled the hearings in this case because it expected the issue would generate a lot of public interest. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Last Wednesday, the top DEC official in Valdez outlined the state's view of what Exxon's winter response plan should be in a letter to the federal on-scene commander, who has the power to demand compliance. The letter was copied to other state officials in the area and to the general manager of Exxon's cleanup program. But on Friday, Exxon officials outlined their demobilization plans to DEC's on-site coordinator, Steve Provant. And Provant says he was surprised to hear that it sounded like Exxon plans to move out entirely over the winter.
That just implies to me that their thinking is that they're probably not going to have a major effort up here next spring.
Provant says he never expected Exxon to totally withdraw by mid-September.
When they talk about demobilizing, they really mean demobilize, and that would be releasing all the vessels from their contracts, and they would return to wherever they came from.
Meanwhile, the federal on-scene coordinator, Rear Admiral Clyde Robbins, says the Coast Guard's plan is not yet formulated.
From the very beginning, when we started this operation, everyone around here said, you better be done by the September 15th, because you can't work beyond September 15th on this kind of an activity. And so all our plans and everything use that as a target date to be finished with this summer's activities. Now to start thinking about working for a longer period than that, when we previously said that's what we were planning it on, is kind of a change of pace that I hadn't expected. So I still have to review that and decide what I'm going to ask that Exxon do.
The state's plan, according to Provant, is not for a major force of thousands, but maybe for a few hundred on site to respond as needed.
There are some things that we feel definitely have to be done, such as additional beach monitoring, overflights looking for release of oil, to be able to respond to threats that may come up to sensitive resources and to any of the fish hatcheries. And have a strike team capability, you know, so that they can get out and either boom off areas or deal with problems that arise.
Provant said he has relayed a number of times to both the Coast Guard and Exxon that DEC thinks winter cleanup activities could take place on Prince William Sound, even though it would be reduced in scope. But Admiral Robbins claims that the first thing he knew of the state's position on a winter task force was Provant's letter of the 12th and State DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso's public announcement of late Friday enlisting the help of the U.S. Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Paul Yost. Kelso urged Yost to stick with the cleanup as long as possible this fall, to maintain progress over the winter, and to plan for early startup in the spring. Admiral Robbins says his understanding with Exxon is that they will return in the spring with whatever is needed.
First of all, we don't know here 2 months before September 15th exactly how far we'll be. We have intended right from the beginning that we would have treated all the beaches initially by the 15th of September, and I would hope that we would have. And if we have, we will then have to decide what is necessary next spring following the winter storms and the winter weathering that will go on. My understanding is that Exxon is prepared to come back with whatever is necessary to continue the cleanup in the spring.
Admiral Robbins says he will be conferring with Admiral Yost to determine what policy the Coast Guard will choose concerning the holdover of Exxon forces during the winter season. Exxon officials were not available for comment. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
There was some confusion initially on here as to what was being dealt with, whether it was a forensic case or an archaeological case. And the state troopers were involved and investigated. And to determine which was which, that analysis is still being done. Originally, it was thought to be a forensic case. It now appears with subsequent information that it may be an archaeological case, and that story is still being put together.
You say subsequent information? You found more things?
More people went out and looked at it, yes.
The state trooper involved in the case has not been available for comment. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Really hard, really tough to, I want to be out there fishing. My boys go fishing with me, my young boys. And
Rob Foster is skipper of the Turning Point.
We've made it through a lot of the botulisms here and a lot of different things, and we're going to make it through this, but at the time, it's a real tough situation.
Foster, along with hundreds of other salmon seiners, would rather work oil cleanup than sit idle in the harbor. But few of the seiners have been hired. Exxon says it requires larger type vessels to carry out the bulk of the cleanup work.
Yeah, I went in and I talked to Exxon the other day, and there's 275 seiners roughly signed up for some kind of cleanup employment charter. And I think there's only 40 seiners being employed right now. And there's definitely a preference for the larger seiners. Like 48 is it seems like that's where their interest drops off. I know there's a few boats, like I think the Keita's out doing some test fishing. But that's it. Everybody else is just sort of drying up on the vine.
That's Misha Noonan, skipper of the Dutch Omega. If money's tight, you can't fish, and you can't get hired for cleanup, there's always the claims office. All salmon fishermen received a $15,000 payment from Exxon to help tide them over for the time being. But boat owners say $15,000 is a drop in the bucket, what with boat payments, insurance payments, and a host of other bills. Chuck McQuethy, owner of the Fiona, says there's also living expenses to consider.
Right now, I've got, between me and the crew on the boat, there's, like 12 people that I'm trying to support on that 15 grand between my crew members and their families. And that's not going to go very far in Kodiak.
At a meeting of the Salmon Task Force last week, Exxon representative John Peavy said it was his understanding fishermen could continue to draw money from the claims office on a regular basis. So McQuethy went down to the claims office to check it out.
They've had no word from higher up to authorize any further interim salmon, payments. And I went out to talk to John Peavy, and he said he'd look into it. Even though last Friday at the task force meeting, he said that it was available. He gave the format on how to do it, what was needed. When I went down to check into it, to get the ball rolling on my claims, they said they didn't know anything about it.
McQuethy says unless seiners put the heat on, they'll simply have to make do until September when the final settlement comes out. He says the fleet should enlist the help of the United Fishermen's Marketing Association. UFMA's manager, Jeff Stephen, was instrumental in helping fishermen get the initial $15,000 payment.
The best thing we can do is join UFMA. I mean, that's getting the ball rolling some way. But realize that this thing isn't going to be, they're not going to be handing us food on a silver platter. We're going to have to fight for it. Or at least put up the format of a fight. Scare them into coming up with an equitable settlement and a timely settlement. There's people now that are strapped. They're in danger of losing their boats. They have payments due. Most boats, that 15 grand won't even cover insurance. And something's got to get rolling now, or it's, the situation could get, to the point of desperate.
Salmon seiner Chuck McQuethy. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Army demolitions experts from Fort Richardson were called to a beach on the Aniakchak National Monument on the Alaska Peninsula over the weekend after a cleanup worker found what he thought was a hand grenade. Using a borrowed rifle, the Army officers shot the grenade, which turned out not to be the explosive type, but a tear gas grenade. Still, they say it was a good thing the Army was called, since the grenade could have caused severe problems had it gone off aboard a boat or in an airplane. Not only is the tear gas disabling, but the grenade burns at a temperature of several thousand degrees. Where it came from, no one knows. Given the currents, the grenade could have floated hundreds of miles before washing ashore near Aniakchak. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
Kent Sturgis was born and raised in Fairbanks, worked as a reporter all over the state, and when his publishing business took him to live in Seattle, the oil spill brought his attention immediately back north. so, with the financial backing of the Alaska Fisherman's Journal, Sturgis is launching a newsletter focused exclusively on the oil spill and its aftermath, from the ongoing cleanup to the upcoming legal and political battles. Sturgis says he expects the court arguments in particular to drag on for years.
Very complex procedural questions to be answered first. Will it be tried in state court or federal court? And there's a question of admiralty law, and there's a question of consolidating plaintiff groups and identifying class actions, and there's more, you know, very fine legal questions than you can shake a stick at.
And those issues themselves may delay the start of any trials until 1991 at the earliest. So the Alaska Oil Spill Reporter figures to be in business for at least that long and possibly longer. There's precedent for this a decade ago when power companies started defaulting on bonds that financed construction of several nuclear power plants in the Northwest. One enterprising journalist started a newsletter about the Whoops disaster and, according to Sturgis, made a living off the publication. He sold it to lawyers, plaintiffs, the power companies, universities, libraries, you name it. And the same goes for the oil spill. Lots of people hungry for information that now is carried only sporadically in the news media outside Alaska.
You see a little bit in Seattle because of the fishing interest, but not a lot elsewhere on any kind of day-by-day basis or even a week-by-week basis.
And that's the void he hopes to fill. The first issue of the Alaska Oil Spill Reporter is due out this weekend. It'll be published on the 1st and 15th of each month, filled mainly with digests of information, but also two or three features. The first profiles colorful Fairbanks attorney Dick Madsen, who's defending the former Exxon Valdez skipper Joseph Hazelwood against criminal charges stemming from the oil spill. Sturgis and his financial backer, publisher John Pappenheimer of the Alaska Fisherman's Journal, hope to sell a couple hundred subscriptions. It's expensive, $350 a year for 25 issues, but for any party to an oil spill lawsuit, for example, that's hardly a drop in the bucket. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Boat owners kicked up a storm several weeks ago when Exxon announced it was lowering charter rates. At that time, Exxon said the rates were non-negotiable. But boat owners threatened to walk off the job if Exxon refused to come to the bargaining table. As a result of discussions with the boat owners, Exxon representative John Peavy announced Monday the terms of the new contracts will be modified. The rates offered by Exxon are to be considered a framework only. Peavy says VECO will negotiate with individual boat owners to determine each vessel's charter rate. On another note, cannery workers suffering from loss of wages because of the oil spill will get some relief. Exxon is paying each documented worker $1,000 to be offset against future claims. The checks will be issued Wednesday. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Several days of negotiations have produced no agreement, and if the state wants to find out how hundreds of Exxon documents relating to the Valdez oil spill were destroyed, it looks as if it will have to be through a court-ordered investigation. Instead of talking to each other, Exxon and the state spent much of Tuesday presenting their versions of the issue to Anchorage Superior Court Judge Milton Souter. A draft agreement for a voluntary inquiry was rejected Tuesday by Exxon. The computer tapes contained backup copies of internal corporate communications on the Exxon Valdez and other subjects. Exxon says the destruction was inadvertent and that no primary oil spill documents have been destroyed. Exxon's court documents claim that the loss of the tapes does not violate the court's order to preserve all spill records. Exxon also claims the state agreed to let the company recycle these computer tapes. State attorneys dispute that. Exxon says the destroyed tapes are insignificant, but one day after the destruction was reported, Exxon computer technician Kenneth Davis was fired. According to court documents filed by the state, Davis believes he was made the scapegoat for the loss of the tapes. He also believes some of the information will be impossible to recover. Exxon attorney Douglas Daly is in Houston this week taking affidavits from Exxon employees involved in the incident. Daly has said affidavits prepared by Exxon's own lawyers will not satisfy the state's curiosity. Judge Souter had originally scheduled a hearing in the case for Wednesday morning, but following a scheduling hearing late Tuesday, the hearing was set for Monday morning before Judge Rene Gonzalez. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
The federal on-scene coordinator, Coast Guard Rear Admiral Clyde Robbins, determined last night that briefings by the steering committee will be only once a week in the future. Back in the early days of this bill, the FOSC briefings were held daily, then eventually cut back to 5 days a week. Recently, the briefings have been three times weekly and rarely lasting much more than a quarter of an hour each. Officials were quick to point out that this does not represent a scaling down of effort or intensity on the cleanup. Rather, it's to provide more detailed summaries of the work and allow many of those actually doing the work to come in from the field and make presentations. Admiral Robbins envisions the new format to be both enhanced and expanded and predicted that Tuesday night briefings in the future will run at least 1.5 to 2 hours in length. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
It's designed so that if any bags break open or spill or leak, it's still within the contained area. Well, any free liquids that might be in the containers are drained off into a holding tank, and then some clay additive is added to make sure that it absorbs any other free liquids in the waste so that there's no leakage during shipment. Some of the auditors were pretty upset and made a lot of squealing noises and so forth, which woke up the caretakers at about 4 o'clock in the morning, who realized what had happened. It's not only right next to the oil tanker shipping lanes and oil terminal facilities itself, it's also in an area where just in the past couple of days a salmon opening resulted in hundreds of boats which are seining in the area. So whoever cut these nets and released the otters sure didn't do them any favors. It's a poor habitat and certainly not where we wanted them to end up.
Nearly 400 sea otters impacted by the oil spill were captured and turned over to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Half of those died. The other 200 still in captivity must be returned to the wild or sent to other homes. Regional coordinator for the sea otter rescue operation, Keith Beha, says work has been in progress on the otter relief strategy since April, and a lot of thought has gone into the final 11-page document, which is dated July 10th.
The animals are now in Valdez or Seward or Jackaloff Bay over near Homer. Most of them will be released to the wild. Some of them are not suitable for release because they're blind, lame, poor health, or maybe too young to take care of themselves in the wild. These animals are probably destined to spend the rest of their lives in aquariums. And so rather than issue permits to the several aquariums who have sought permission to capture otters from the wild, we will direct that these non-releasable animals salvaged from the spill be used to fill those requests.
11 of the animals sent to aquariums in the early days of the spill are still surviving, and Beha says those, along with the current non-releasables, should be enough for any necessary evidence of impact in the future.
There's going to be the 11 or so that have already been sent to other aquariums, plus four that I'm aware of that will join them, and we think that'll be 50 animals, something like that. We think that'll be sufficient for a study of long-term chronic impacts from the spill.
So none of the otters are being retained solely as evidence. All animals being kept have some other reason for their confinement. And for the sea otters that will be returned to the wild, there is a very carefully structured plan that includes options at almost every step. According to Beha, six impacted otters were released in the eastern Prince William Sound on the 15th of May with flipper tag radios to determine if the animals would stay in the clean, unoiled waters or whether they'd return to their homes in the southwestern portion of the sound. Unfortunately, only two of the radios worked for the 30-day tracking period. Beha calls the evidence inconclusive, but says it looks like the habitat of eastern Prince William Sound is rich enough and desirable enough that the animals don't have any good reason for leaving. But the release strategy has built-in options as Fish and Wildlife continues monitoring the otters released. If the animals stay in the eastern portion of the sound, great. If they travel back to the southwest, where they were first captured and appear to be doing well, okay. If the otters travel back to the fouled waters and demonstrate stress and the same problems that indicated their need for rescue in the first place, Beha says Fish and Wildlife will consider translocating the animals to some far distant place out of the sound but still in Alaska. If it's impossible to determine where the otters go or how they manage, the remaining otters will be held until the sound is cleaner or a different location is decided on. Beha says it all depends on the results of the second group, which are set to be released from the Valdez Otter Center perhaps as early as next week. The only question remaining before that release is the otter's ability to withstand the minor surgery needed to implant tiny transmitting radios.
The surgery team that's going to be doing the work has done this sort of radio implant over 200 times with no problems. The only real question, I guess, we have is, with these animals that have been subjected to the toxic impacts of the oil, is their health in some way impaired such that they will respond to the surgical implant differently than normal animals do?
U.S. Fish and Wildlife is taking a conservative approach to be sure that what's expected is in fact what's happening and is of benefit to the otter's welfare. Beha says it's only justice to the sea otters to maximize whatever knowledge can be gained from the whole experience, and that's what the implanting of the radios and the monitoring is all about. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Apley.
We would have released most of these otters in about a week or so anyway, but not there. That particular location is not exactly what we have in mind for choice otter habitat.
The Department of Environmental Conservation says that DEC personnel have reported shoreline segments approved for demobilization which have never been treated. DEC's daily report says segments 3, 4, and 6 of Ushagat Island were approved for demobilization on the 11th. The Homer Shoreline Treatment section of the report says these segments consist of rocky headlands and high-energy environments. They're difficult to access, so ground inspections were not performed. No oil was observed during aerial inspection, and to date, DEC has observed no treatment performed in these areas. Under management issues, the Daily Summary says similar reports have been received previously from Seward and Homer, but DEC feels only those areas which have been treated should be included in the demobilization mileage count. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Someone set them free right next to the pipeline terminal. Seems kind of like a cruel joke or an insult to the otters. I don't know what the intentions were, but the people who released them didn't have their heads on right, I guess.
Kelso says Exxon's work may not be over just because the company's announced deadline of September 15th is approaching. In comments released Friday afternoon, the DEC commissioner said he's worried that beaches that seem clean now may be re-oiled once oil below the surface starts percolating up.
It's really important to get this job done right, and the only way to do that is to stick with it as long as possible this fall, do a thorough job of maintaining the progress over the winter and planning for an early startup in the spring.
Kelso says the Coast Guard already has asked Exxon for a plan on withdrawing from the Sound, at least through the winter, but the commissioner wants an Exxon-funded strike team to stay behind to cope with emergencies in case oil starts to threaten hatcheries or other environmentally sensitive spots. Kelso says he's asking Coast Guard Commandant Paul Yost for help.
I've written to Admiral Yost of the U.S. Coast Guard asking his help in making sure that Exxon sticks with the shoreline oil removal operation and the effort to get the oil out of the water. We need to make sure that that effort continues as long as weather conditions and safety considerations allow.
The Coast Guard has been overseeing the Prince William Sound cleanup effort for the past 4 months. In Anchorage, I'm Roseanne Smith.
Bill Love calls it his miracle cleaner. It is clear, a little thicker than water, non-toxic, and biodegradable. The label says Formula 212, and Love says he's ready to sell it to anyone who thinks they can use it, especially Exxon, if they'd like to try it to clean up spilled crude oil. Love won't say what's in Formula 212, but he's happy enough to demonstrate how it cleans up Prudhoe Bay crude. He got a sample of the black goo right out of the Trans-Alaska pipeline at the MAPCO refinery in North Pole, and he's been testing the Formula 212 on the oil under different conditions. On a sunny day in Fairbanks, he brings out a wash tub coated with black crude oil. In it, there's a rock that's been sitting in the stuff for almost 2 weeks.
This rock has been sitting with oil on it for about a week or two. Let's see what it does. It's going to be yucky. I don't know if this is going to be hot enough.
That's amazing. It sheets off.
Yeah, It breaks, I don't know, change the molecular structure of it, and it makes it thinner. I'm no chemist. You want to brave rubbing your finger right there?
Yeah, I do.
It's right there. How does it feel?
Now
feel out over
I
the
kind
side.
Of thought it would feel slimy, but it doesn't. Bill Love owns Solid Rock Cleaning and is known around Fairbanks for his window cleaning business. He's been calling Exxon, the Coast Guard, and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He wants to go to Valdez and demonstrate the cleaner on beach rocks. He believes in its product, and he's not afraid to show it, even by drinking it.
How biodegradable is it?
Want a drink?
Oh, don't do that. Oh, I can't believe you did that.
It's biodegradable, non-toxic.
What does it taste like?
Salt. Kind of yucky taste. Like I could use a Rolaid or something.
Love figures if he can stand drinking the clear liquid, it must be the perfect solution for getting weathered oil off the delicate and sensitive environment of the Gulf of Alaska. But he has yet to convince cleanup officials.
I called the local DEC. They say, call DEC down there, and everybody's so deluded and deluged down there that, sure, okay, we'll get with you. Yeah, right. We'll call you back. I must have spent, maybe $60 in long-distance phone calls.
But Department of Environmental Conservation officials say they don't have the authority to approve cleanup methods. They do, however, encourage people to call the laboratories that are now testing different chemicals and techniques. Lynn Cochran at the DEC office in Valdez says she's referring people to a lab on the East Coast.
Anybody who has any products that they solicit, we go ahead and we forward it to the U.S. Coast Guard in Groton, Connecticut. They have a research and development center. And that research, it is through them that they are the ones that do testing. DEC is not a testing facility.
There's also an Exxon laboratory and an EPA laboratory in New Jersey that are doing research on the oil spill. Joe Bridgman of DEC says he thinks that's where Bill Love's Formula 212 should go.
If somebody has a promising product, they should go through these labs, because who knows, it might really be a winner. And they're doing themselves a disservice by not submitting their product to these labs, because that's the way to do it. Who knows? They might have a real sleeper on their hands.
Bridgman says things are not so bad in his office that he can't listen to people calling in with new ideas and products. And they still come in all the time.
A few days ago, I found in my office here, when I came in one morning, a can, it looked like a 2 or 3 gallon can of unidentified fluid. And all the labels were in a script I wasn't familiar with. I think it was Japanese, but I presume it was Japanese. Well, my goodness, we didn't know what the heck to do with this. I mean, we didn't know if somebody was out to get us or what it was. There was no accompanying literature or anything. It was just this can of fluid.
Bridgman says the fluid should probably be analyzed at one of the East Coast labs. As for Bill Love, he will still try to put his miracle oil cleaner to work in Alaska. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
There are several test sites staked out around Prince William Sound for various experiments currently in progress, and others are being proposed. But to date, according to reports given at the Federal On-Scene Coordinator's briefing on Tuesday, no set-aside plots for study have as yet been approved by the Interagency Shoreline Cleanup Committee. The original list submitted by Exxon to the ISCC was rejected as too long and varied. The ISCC wanted experimental plots confined to a few areas in order to allow the cleanup of maximum beaches. But officials said that as it turns out in the field, some marked test sites have been avoided while others were ignored and cleaned. One of the test sites cleaned had been staked out by Dames & Moore, an environmental consulting firm currently under contract with Exxon to study the biological effects of the oil spill. Since one of its study sites had been cleaned, the data gathered actually related more to the biological effects of the cleanup treatment rather than the effects of the oil. Since the study was only in one small area and the data only accidentally recovered, officials are hesitant to release any information, and they stress they have only very preliminary test results. According to David Kennedy, the scientific support coordinator for NOAA, the small amount of information gathered so far only means that there should be a closer look at how much cleaning can occur before there's a negative return for effort.
I did meet with Dames & Moore a couple of three nights ago to discuss some transects that they have been running to look at beaches that have been oiled and then beaches that have been cleaned. And they presented some very preliminary data, which I don't believe it's my place to release or discuss. But the data was to try the data that they gave me, which once again is preliminary, and I think probably needs some more work before they're going to be willing to release it. Was discussing what effect the cleanup itself may have on beaches, and it's something that I've been concerned about for some time, and that's what we discussed, and we decided after looking at the data that. It's an issue that obviously still needs to be discussed further and is some concern. We need to look, I think, a little more closely at how much cleaning in some areas we ought to be doing before you begin to get, a negative return for your effort.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really about all I can say.
Where will it go from here?
Both of us went away from that meeting with action items to... look more closely at what little we know and as quickly as possible review everything and then at that point make all of this public so that we can review the situation with all the agencies that obviously are going to need to listen.
So will that be a different forum than, say, the Shoreline Cleanup Committee? Or?
No. In fact, that would most certainly be one of the forums, probably one of the first forums.
Mm-hmm.
David Kennedy, the Scientific Support Coordinator for NOAA. Kennedy says action items include a closer look at the raw data and independent interpretation of the data. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Kodiak's National Marine Fisheries Service performed animal autopsies or necropsies on the whales to determine the cause of death. But because of a gag order imposed by the state, the results of the necropsies are not being released. It's the same story with the land mammals, such as deer, found dead since Exxon Valdez oil hit the island. Department of Fish and Game officials say they're not even allowed to speculate or offer personal opinions about the cause of death of the wildlife. The reason given for the secrecy is the state may want to use the scientific evidence in future litigation. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
They have some recommended areas and such, but they don't have any standards. And so what we're working with EPA specialists as well as our own technical specialists to come up with, say, what's a criteria that is going to provide the reasonable assurance that we're not going to create a bigger problem than we already have. Companies that have applied separately to the state for permits in hopes that if they get the permit, Exxon would hire their company to assist in disposal of the waste.
Basically, this wasn't an outrageous event. There's no smoking gun. There's no broken piece of machinery on the vessel. There's no autopilot that didn't let him turn the thing. There wasn't a captain behaving loudly and outrageously, although he certainly behaved outrageously, being the master of the vessel. It's very clear from everything that we went through at the NTSB hearings and from all of their backup information that they've made part of the record that Exxon Shipping Company just did an execrable job of managing their personnel in this instance. They had a known alcoholic in their employ. They didn't do for that man, Captain Hazelwood, what any employee of a large corporation should have done for him. They didn't give him the wherewithal to recover from his alcoholism. They didn't assure that he did so. They didn't monitor him in a proper fashion. Their alleged monitoring program would be laughable if it didn't result in such a terrible tragedy in the end. Personally, Alyeska's behavior in this instance just pretty much confirmed what all Alaskans have known for the last 15 years or so, that Alyeska is just a joke. It's a veil that the seven owner companies, the Prudhoe producers, which includes all the big ones, have created basically to try to protect themselves from what they've in the past considered are irritating and irrelevant state regulatory procedures under the Pipeline Right-of-Way Act.
The three-judge panel struck down Interior's damage assessment regulations, ruling that in most cases, spillers should pay whatever it takes to restore a damaged area to its former condition. Interior has been using regulations which compare the cost of restoring the environment to the market value of the resources that are lost in a spill, and paying whichever is less. For example, a lost fur seal would be worth about $15, the market value of its fur. In a variety of situations, these market value alternatives let the spiller off the hook for the much greater cost of restoring the site. The suit against the regulations was brought by 10 states and the National Wildlife Federation. Federation spokesperson Eric Olson called the ruling a significant victory for the environment.
Basically, what the court said was that those who spill oil and those who pollute the environment from hazardous waste sites